Strange summoned another vision of Hougomont. The men there had suffered greatly since he had last seen the chateau. The wounded of both sides lay in every room. The haystack, outbuildings, and chateau were all on fire. Black, choking smoke was everywhere. Horses screamed, and wounded men tried to crawl away. But there was hardly anywhere to go. Meanwhile, the battle raged on around them. In the chapel, Strange found half a dozen images of saints painted on the walls. They were 7 or 8 feet tall and oddly proportioned, the work, it seemed, of an enthusiastic amateur. They had long brown beards and large melancholy eyes. "They'll do," he muttered. At his command, the saints stepped down from the walls. They moved in a series of jerks like marionettes, but they had a certain lightness and grace. They stalked through the ranks of wounded men to a well in one of the courtyards. Here they drew buckets of water, which they carried to the flames. All seemed to be going well, until two of them, possibly St. Peter and St. Jerome, caught fire and burnt up. Being composed of nothing but paint and magic, they burnt rather easily. Strange was trying to think how to remedy this situation when part of an exploded French shell hit the side of his silver dish, sending it spinning 50 yards to the right. By the time he had retrieved it, knocked out a large dent in its side and set it to rights, all the painted saints had succumbed to the flames. Wounded men and horses were burning. There were no more paintings upon the walls. Almost brought to tears by his frustration, Strange cursed the unknown artist for his idleness. What else was there? What else did he know? He thought hard. Long ago, John Usklas would sometimes make a champion for himself out of ravens. Birds would flock together to become a black, bristling, shifting giant who could perform any task with ease. On other occasions, Usklas would make servants out of earth. Strange conjured a vision of Hougomont's well. He drew the water out of the well in a sort of fountain, and then, before the fountain could spill on the ground, he forced it to take on the clumsy semblance of a man. Next, he commanded the waterman to hurry to the flames and cast himself down upon them. In this way, a stall in the stables was successfully doused, and three men were saved. Strange made more as quickly as he could, but water is not an element that holds a coherent form easily. After an hour or so of this labor, his head was spinning and his hands were shaking uncontrollably. Between 4 and 5 o'clock, something entirely unexpected happened. Strange looked up to see a brilliant mass of French cavalry approaching. 500 abreast they rode, and 12 deep. Yet the thunder of the guns was such that they made no sound that anyone could hear. They seemed to come silently. Surely, thought Strange, they must realize that Wellington's infantry is unbroken. They'll be cut to pieces. Behind him, the infantry regiments were forming squares. Some of the men called to Strange to come and shelter inside their square. This seemed like good advice, and so he went. From the relative safety of the square, Strange watched the cavalry's approach. The cuirassiers wore shining breastplates and tall crested helmets. The lancers' weapons were embellished with fluttering pennants of red and white. They seemed scarcely to belong to this dull age. Theirs was the glory of ancient days. But Strange was determined to match it with an ancient glory of his own. The images of John Usklas' servants burnt in his mind. Servants made of ravens, servants made of earth. Beneath the French horsemen, the mud began to swell and bubble. It shaped itself into gigantic hands. The hands reached up and pulled down men and horses. The ones who fell were trampled by their comrades. The rest endured a storm of musket fire from the Allied infantry. Strange watched impassively. When the French had been beaten back, he returned to his silver dish.
"Are you the magician?" said someone.
He spun round and was astonished to find a little round, soft-looking person in civilian clothes who smiled at him. "Who in God's name are you?" he demanded.
"My name is Pink," explained the man. "I'm a commercial traveller for Welbeck's Superior Buttons of Birmingham. I have a message from the Duke for you."
Strange, who was covered in mud and more tired than he had ever been in his life, took a moment to comprehend this. "Where are all the Duke's aides-de-camp?"
"He says that they're dead."
"What? Hadley Bryce is dead? What about Colonel Canning?"
"Alas," smiled Mr. Pink, "I can offer no precise information. I came out from Antwerp yesterday to see the battle, and when I espied the Duke, I took the opportunity to introduce myself and to mention in passing the excellent qualities of Welbeck's Superior Buttons. He asked me as a particular favour to come and tell you that that the Prussian army is on their way here and have reached Paris Wood. But, says His Grace, they're having the devil of a time.
Mr. Pink smiled and blinked to hear himself say such a soldiery word.
The devil of a time in their little lanes and mud. And would you be so good as to make a road for them between the wood and the battlefield?
Certainly, said Strange, rubbing some of the mud from his face.
I'll tell His Grace.
He paused and asked wistfully,
Do you think His Grace would like to order some buttons?
I do not see why not. He is as fond of buttons as most men.
Then, you know, we could put supplier of buttons to His Grace the Duke of Wellington in all our advertisements.
Mr. Pink beamed happily.
Off I go, then.
Yes, off you go. Strange created the road for the Prussians, but in later times he was always inclined to suppose he must have dreamt Mr. Pink of Welbeck's superior buttons. Footnote 6. In actual fact, Mr. Pink was only one of the civilians whom the Duke pressed into service as unofficial aides-de-camp that day. Others included a young Swiss gentleman and another commercial traveller, this time from London. Events seemed to repeat themselves. Again and again the French cavalry charged, and Strange took refuge within the infantry square. Again the deadly horsemen swirled against the sides of the square like waves. Again Strange drew monstrous hands from the earth to pull them down. Whenever the cavalry withdrew, the cannonade began again. He returned to his silver dish and made men out of water to put out the flames and succor the dying in the ruined, desperate Hougoumont. Everything happened over and over, again and again. It was inconceivable that the fighting would ever end. He began to think it had always been like this. There must come a time when the musket balls and cannon shot run out, he thought. But what will we do then? Hack at each other with sabres and bayonets? And if we all die, every one of us, who would they say has won? The smoke rolled back, revealing frozen moments like tableau in a ghostly theatre. At the farmhouse called La Haye Sainte, the French were climbing a mountain of their own dead to get over the wall and kill the German defenders. Once Strange was caught outside the square when the French arrived. Suddenly, directly in front of him, was an enormous French cuirassier upon an equally enormous horse. His first thought was to wonder if the fellow knew who he was. He had been told the entire French army hated the English magician with a vivid Latin passion. His second thought was that he had left his pistols inside the infantry square. The cuirassier raised his sabre. Without thinking, Strange muttered Stokes's Animan evocare. Something like a bee flew out of the breast of the cuirassier and settled in the palm of Strange's hand. But it was not a bee. It was a bead of pearly blue light. A second light flew out of the cuirassier's horse. The horse screamed and reared up. The cuirassier stared, puzzled. Strange raised his other hand to smash horse and horseman out of existence. Then he froze. And can a magician kill a man by magic? The Duke had asked. And he had answered, A magician might, but a gentleman never could. While he was hesitating, a British cavalry officer, a Scots grey, swung round out of nowhere. He slashed the cuirassier's head open from his chin upwards through his teeth. The man toppled like a tree. The Scots grey rode on. Strange could never quite remember what happened after this. He believed that he wandered about in a dazed condition. He did not know for how long. The sound of cheering brought him to himself. He looked up and saw Wellington upon Copenhagen. He was waving his hat, the signal that the Allies were to advance upon the French. But the smoke wreathed itself so thickly about the Duke that only the soldiers nearest to him could share in this moment of victory. So Strange whispered a word, and a little gap appeared in the billows. A single ray of evening sunlight shone down upon Wellington. All along the ridge, the faces of the soldiers turned towards him. The cheering grew louder. There, thought Strange, that is the proper use of English magic. He followed the soldiers and the retreating French down through the battlefield. Scattered about among the dead and the dying were the great earthen hands he had created. They seemed frozen in gestures of outrage and horror, as if the land itself despaired. When he came level with the French guns that had done the Allied soldiers such profound injury, he did one last act of magic. He drew more hands out of the earth. The hands grasped the cannons and pulled them under. At the Inn of Belle Alliance, on the far side of the battlefield, He found the Duke with the Prussian general, Prince Blücher. The Duke nodded to him and said, "Come to dinner with me." Prince Blücher shook his hand warmly and said a great many things in German, none of which Strange understood. Then the old gentleman pointed to his stomach, wherein lay the illusory elephant, and made a wry face as if to say, "What can one do?" Strange stepped outside, and immediately he almost walked into Captain Hadley Bright. "I was told you were dead," he cried.
"I was sure you would be," replied Hadley Bright.
There was a pause. Both men felt faintly embarrassed. The ranks of dead and wounded stretched away upon all sides as far as the eye could see. Simply, being alive at that moment seemed in some indefinable way ungentlemanly.
"Who else survived, do you know?"
asked Hadley Bright. Strange shook his head.
"No,"
they parted. At Wellington's headquarters in Waterloo that night, the table was laid for 40 or 50 people. But when the dinner hour came, only 3 men were there. The Duke, General Alvar, his Spanish attaché, and Strange. Whenever the door opened, the Duke turned his head to see if it was one of his friends, alive and well. But no one came. Many places at that table have been laid for gentlemen who were either dead or dying. Colonel Canning, Lieutenant Colonel Gordon, Major General Picton, Colonel Delancey. The list would grow longer as the night progressed. The Duke, General Alvar, and Mr. Strange sat down in silence. Chapter 41. Staircross. Late September to December 1815. Fortune, it seemed, could not be persuaded to smile upon Mr. Segundus. He had come to live in York with the aim of enjoying the society and conversation of the city's many magicians. But no sooner had he got there than all the other magicians were deprived of their profession by Mr. Norrell, and he was left alone. His little stock of money had dwindled considerably, and in the autumn of 1815 he was forced to seek employment. "And is it not to be supposed," he remarked to Mr. Honeyfoot with a sigh, "that I shall be able to earn very much? What am I qualified to do?" Mr. Honeyfoot could not allow this. "Write to Mr. Strange," he advised. "He may be in need of a secretary." Nothing would have pleased Mr. Segundus better than to work for Jonathan Strange, but his natural modesty would not allow him to propose it. It would be a shocking thing to put himself forward in such a way. Mr. Strange might be embarrassed to know how to answer him. It might even look as if he, John Segundus, considered himself Mr. Strange's equal. Mr. and Mrs. Honeyfoot assured him that if Mr. Strange did not like the idea, he would very soon say so, and so there could be no possible harm in asking him. But upon this point, Mr. Segundus proved unpersuadable. Their next proposal, however, pleased him better.
"Why not see if there are any little boys in the town who wish to learn magic?" asked Mrs. Honeyfoot.
Her grandsons, stout little fellows of 5 and 7, were just now of an age to begin their education, and so the subject rather occupied her mind. So Mr. Segundus became a tutor in magic. As well as little boys, he also discovered some young ladies whose studies would have more usually been confined to French, German, and music, but who were now anxious to be instructed in theoretical magic. Soon he was asked to give lessons to the young ladies' older brothers, many of whom began to picture themselves as magicians. To young men of a studious turn of mind, who did not desire to go into the church or the law, magic was very appealing, particularly since Strange had triumphed on the battlefields of Europe. It is, after all, many centuries since clergymen distinguished themselves on the field of war, and lawyers never have. In the early autumn of 1815, Mr. Segundus was engaged by the father of one of his pupils upon an errand. This gentleman, whose name was Palmer, had heard of a house in the north of the country that was being sold. Mr. Palmer did not wish to buy the house, but a friend had told him that there was a library there worth examining. Mr. Palmer was not at leisure just then to go and see for himself. Though he trusted his servants in many other matters, their talents did not quite run to scholarship. So he asked Mr. Segundus to go in his place, to find out how many books there were and what their condition might be, and whether they were worth purchasing. Staircross Hall was the principal building in a village which otherwise comprised a handful of stone cottages and farmhouses. Staircross itself stood in a most isolated spot, surrounded on all sides by brown, empty moors. Tall trees sheltered it from storms and winds, yet at the same time they made it dark and solemn. The village was amply provided with tumble-down stone walls and tumble-down stone barns. It was very quiet. It felt like the end of the world. There was a very ancient and worn-looking pack-horse bridge that crossed a deep beck of fast-running water. Bright yellow leaves flowed swiftly upon the dark, almost black, water, making patterns as they went. To Mr. Zagandus, the patterns looked a little like magical writing. But then, he thought, so many things do. The house itself was a long, low, rambling building, constructed of the same dark stone as the rest of the village. Its neglected gardens, garths, and courts were filled with deep drifts of autumn leaves. It was hard to know who would wish to buy such a house. It was much too large for a farmhouse, yet altogether too gloomy and remote for a gentleman's residence. It might have done for a parsonage, except that there was no church. It might have done for an inn, except that the old pack road that had once passed through the village had fallen into disuse, and the bridge was all that remained of it. No one came in answer to Mr. Segundus's knock. He observed that the front door was ajar. It seemed rather impertinent simply to go inside, but after 4 or 5 minutes of fruitless knocking, he did so. Houses, like people, are apt to become rather eccentric if left too much on their own. This house was the architectural equivalent of an old gentleman in a worn dressing gown and torn slippers, who got up and went to bed at odd times of day, and who kept up a continual conversation with friends no one else could see. As Mr. Segundus wandered about in search of whoever was in charge, he found a room which contained nothing but china cheese moulds, all stacked one upon another. Another room had heaps of queer red clothes, the like of which he had never seen before, something between labourer's smocks and clergyman's robes. The kitchen had very few of those articles that usually belonged to kitchens, but it did have the skull of an alligator in a glass case. The skull had a great grin and seemed very pleased with itself, though Mr. Segundus did not know why it should be. There was one room that could only be reached by a queer arrangement of steps and staircases, where the pictures all seemed to have been chosen by someone with an inordinate love of fighting. There were pictures of men fighting, boys fighting, cocks fighting, bulls fighting, dogs fighting, centaurs fighting, and even a startling depiction of two beetles locked in combat. Another room was almost empty, except for a doll's house standing on a table in the middle of the floor. The doll's house was an exact copy of the real house, except that inside the doll's house a number of smartly dressed dolls were enjoying a peaceful and rational existence together, making doll-sized cakes and loaves of bread, entertaining their friends with a diminutive harpsichord, playing casino with tiny cards, educating miniature children, and dining upon roast turkeys the size of Mr. Segundus's thumbnail. It formed a strange contrast with the bleak, echoing reality. He seemed to have looked in every room, but he still had not found the library, and he had still not found any people. He came to a small door, half hidden by a staircase. Behind it was a tiny room, scarcely more than a closet. A man in a dirty white coat with his boots propped up on the table was drinking brandy and staring at the ceiling. After a little persuasion, this person agreed to show him where the library was. The first 10 books Mr. Segundus looked at were worthless, books of sermons and moralizing from the last century, or descriptions of persons whom no one living cared about. The next 50 were very much the same. He began to think his task would soon be done. But then he stumbled upon some very interesting and unusual works of geology, philosophy, and medicine. He began to feel more sanguine. He worked steadily for 2 or 3 hours. Once he thought he heard a carriage arrive at the house, but he paid it no attention. At the end of that time, he was suddenly aware that he was extremely hungry. He had no idea whether any arrangements had been made for his dinner or not, and the house was a long way from the nearest inn. He went off in search of the negligent man in the tiny room to ask him what could be done. In the labyrinth of rooms and corridors, he was lost immediately. He wandered about, opening every door, feeling more and more hungry, and more out of temper with the negligent man. He found himself in an old-fashioned parlour, with dark oak panelling and a mantelpiece the size of a young triumphal arch. Directly before him, A lovely young woman was sitting in a deep window seat, gazing out at the trees and the high bare hills beyond. He had just time enough to notice that her left hand lacked a little finger, when suddenly she was not there at all. Or perhaps it was more accurate to say she changed. In her place was a much older, stouter woman, a woman about Mr. Secundus's own age, dressed in a violet silk gown with an Indian shawl about her shoulders and a little dog in her lap. This lady sat in exactly the same attitude as the other, gazing out of the window with the same wistful expression. All these details took but a moment to apprehend, yet the impression made upon Mr. Secundus by the two ladies was unusually vivid, almost supernaturally so, like images in a delirium. A queer shock thrilled through his whole being. His senses were overwhelmed, and he fainted away. When he came to himself, he was lying on the floor, and two ladies were leaning over him, with exclamations of dismay and concern. Despite his confusion, he quickly comprehended that neither lady was the beautiful young woman with the missing finger whom he'd seen first. One was the lady with the little dog, whom he had seen second, and the other was a thin, fair-haired, equally mature lady of unremarkable face and figure. It appeared that she had been in the room all along, but she'd been seated behind the door, and so he had not observed her. The two ladies would not permit him to stand up or attempt any movement of his limbs. They would scarcely allow him to speak. They warned him sternly it would bring on another fainting fit. They fetched cushions for his head and blankets to keep him warm. He protested he was perfectly warm to begin with, but they would not listen to him. They dispensed lavender water and sal volatile. They stopped a draught they thought might be coming from under one of the doors. Mr. Secundus began to suspect that they'd had an uneventful morning, and that when a strange gentleman had walked into the room and dropped down in a swoon, they were rather pleased than otherwise. After a quarter of an hour of this treatment, he was permitted to sit in a chair and sip weak tea unaided.
"The fault is entirely mine," said the lady with the little dog. "Fellows told me that the gentleman had come from York to see the books. I ought to have made myself known to you before. It was too great a shock coming upon us like that."
The name of this lady was Mrs. Lennox. The other was Mrs. Blake, her companion. They generally resided in Bath, and they had come to Staircross so that Mrs. Lennox might see the house one more time before it was sold.
"Foolish, is it not?" said Mrs. Lennox to Mr. Secundus. "The house has stood vacant for years and years. I ought to have sold it long ago, but when I was a child, I spent several summers here, which were particularly happy." "You are still very pale, sir," offered Mrs. Blake. "Have you eaten anything today?"
Mr. Secundus confessed that he was very hungry.
"Did not Fellows offer to fetch your dinner?" asked Mrs. Lennox in surprise.
Fellows was presumably the negligent servant in the tiny room. Mr. Secundus did not like to say that he had barely been able to rouse Fellows to speak to him. Fortunately, Mrs. Lennox and Mrs. Blake had brought an ample dinner with them, and Fellows was at that moment preparing it. Half an hour later, the two ladies and Mr. Secundus sat down to dine in an oak-panelled room with a melancholy view of autumn trees. The only slight inconvenience was that the two ladies wished Mr. Secundus, in his invalid character, to eat light, easily digestible foods, whereas in truth he was very hungry and wanted fried beefsteaks and hot pudding. The two ladies were glad of a companion and asked him a great many questions about himself. They were most interested to learn that he was a magician. They had never met one before.
"And have you found any magical texts in my library?" asked Mrs. Lennox.
"None, madam," said Mr. Secundus.
"But magical books, valuable ones, are very rare indeed. I would have been most surprised to find any." "Now that I think of it," mused Mrs. Lennox, "I believe there were a few. But I sold them all years ago to a gentleman who lived near York. Just between ourselves, I thought him a little foolish to pay me such a great sum for books no one wanted. But perhaps he was wise after all."
Mr. Secundus knew that the gentleman who lived near York had probably not paid Mrs. Lennox one quarter the proper value of the books. But it does no good to say such things out loud, and so he smiled politely and kept his reflections to himself. He told them about his pupils, both male and female, and how clever they were and how eager to learn.
"And since you encouraged them with such praise," said Mrs. Blake kindly, They are sure to fare better under your tutelage than they would with any other master.
I do not know about that, said Mr. Segundus.
I have not quite understood before, said Mrs. Lennox with a thoughtful air, how universally popular the study of magic has become. I had thought that it was confined to those two men in London. What are their names? Presumably, Mr. Segundus, the next step is a school for magicians. Doubtless that is where you will direct your energies.
A school, said Mr. Segundus.
But that will require... I do not know what exactly, but a great deal of money and a house.
Perhaps there would be difficulty in acquiring pupils, said Mrs. Lennox.
No, indeed. I can think of four young men immediately.
And if you were to advertise?
But I would never do that, said Mr. Segundus, rather shocked. Magic is the noblest profession in the world. The second noblest, perhaps, after the church. One ought not to soil it with commercial practices. No, I would only take young men upon private recommendation.
Then all that remains is for someone to find you a little money and a house. Nothing could be easier. But I dare say your friend Mr. Honeyfoot, of whom you speak with such regard, would wish to lend you the money. I dare say he would want to claim that honour for his own.
Oh, no. Mr. Honeyfoot has three daughters, the dearest girls in the world. One of them is married, and another is engaged, and the third cannot make up her mind. No, Mr. Honeyfoot must think of his family. His money is quite tied up.
Then I can tell you my hope with a clear conscience. Why should I not lend you the money?
Mr. Segundus was all amazement, and for several moments quite at a loss for an answer.
You are very kind, madam, he stammered at last.
Mrs. Lennox smiled.
No, sir, I am not. If magic is as popular as you say, and I shall, of course, ascertain the opinion of other people upon this point, then I believe the profits will be handsome.
But my experience of business is woefully small, said Mr. Segundus. I should fear to make a mistake and lose you your money.
No, you're very kind, and I thank you with all my heart, but I must decline.
Well, if you dislike the notion of becoming a borrower of money, and I know it does not suit everyone, then that is easily solved. The school shall be mine, mine alone. I will bear the expense and the risk. You will be master of the school, and our names will appear upon the prospectus together. After all, what better purpose for this house could there be than as a school for magicians? As a residence, it has many drawbacks, but its advantages as a school are considerable. It is a very isolated situation. There is no shooting to speak of. There would be little opportunity for the young men to gamble or hunt. Their pleasures will be quite restricted, and so they will apply themselves to their studies.
I would not choose young men who gamble, said Mr. Segundus, rather shocked.
She smiled again. I do not believe you have ever given your friends a moment's anxiety, except for worrying that this wicked world would quickly take advantage of someone so honest. After dinner, Mr. Segundus dutifully returned to the library, and in the early evening he took his leave of the two ladies. They parted in a most friendly manner, and with a promise on Mrs. Lennox's side that she would soon invite him to Bath. On the way back, he gave himself stern warnings not to place any reliance on these wonderful plans for future usefulness and happiness. But he could not help indulging in ideal pictures of teaching the young men and of their extraordinary progress. Of Jonathan Strange coming to visit the school, of his pupils being delighted to discover that their master was a friend and intimate of the most famous magician of the modern age, of Strange saying to him, "It is all excellent, Segundus. I could not be better pleased. Well done." It was after midnight when he got home, and it took all his resolve not to run to Mr. Honeyfoot's house immediately to tell him the news. But the following morning, when he arrived at the house at a very early hour, their raptures were scarcely to be described. They were full of the happiness he had hardly dare allow himself to feel. Mrs. Honeyfoot still had a great deal of the schoolgirl in her, and she caught up her husband's hands and danced around the breakfast table with him as the only possible means of expressing what she felt. Then she took Mr. Segundus's hands and danced around the table with him, and when both magicians protested against any more dancing, she continued by herself. Mr. Segundus's only regret, and it was a very slight one,
was that Mr. and Mrs. Honeyfoot did not feel the surprise of the thing quite as he intended they should. Their opinion of him was so high that they found nothing particularly remarkable in great ladies wishing to establish schools solely for his benefit.
"She may consider herself very lucky to have found you," declared Mr. Honeyfoot, "for who is better fitted to direct a school for magicians? No one."
"And after all," reasoned Mrs. Honeyfoot, "what else has she to do with her money? Poor childless lady."
Mr. Honeyfoot was convinced that Mr. Segundus's fortune was now made. His sanguine temper would not permit him to expect less. Yet he had not lived so long in the world without acquiring some sober habits of business, and he told Mr. Segundus that they would make some inquiries about Mrs. Lennox, who she was, and whether she was as rich as she seemed. They wrote to a friend of Mr. Honeyfoot's who lived in Bath. Fortunately, Mrs. Lennox was well known as a great lady, even in Bath, a city beloved by the rich and the elevated. She had been born rich and married an even richer husband. This husband had died young and not much regretted, leaving her at liberty to indulge her active temperament and clever mind. She had increased her fortune with good investments and careful management of her lands and estates. She was famed for her bold, decisive temper, her many charitable activities, and the warmth of her friendship. She had houses in every part of the kingdom, but resided chiefly at Bath with Mrs. Blake. Meanwhile, Mrs. Lennox had been asking the same sort of questions about Mr. Segundus, and she must have been pleased with the answers, because she soon invited him up to Bath, where every detail of the projected school was quickly decided. The next months were spent in repairing and fitting up Staircross Hall. The roof leaked. Two chimneys were blocked, and part of the kitchen had actually fallen down. Mr. Segundus was shocked to discover how much everything would cost. He calculated that if he did not clear the second chimney, made do with old country settles and wooden chairs instead of buying new furniture, and confine the number of servants to three, he could save £60. His letter to this effect produced an immediate reply from Mrs. Lennox. She informed him he was not spending enough. His pupils would all be from good families. They would expect good fires and comfort. She advised him to engage 9 servants, in addition to a butler and a French cook. He must completely refurnish the house and purchase a cellar of good French wines. The cutlery, she said, must all be silver, and the dining service, Wedgwood. In early December, Mr. Segundus received a letter of congratulation from Jonathan Strange, who promised to visit the school the following spring. But in spite of everyone's good wishes and everyone's endeavours, Mr. Segundus could not get rid of the feeling that the school would never actually come into being. Something would occur to prevent it. This idea was constantly at the back of his thoughts, do what he would to suppress it. One morning, around the middle of December, he arrived at the hall and found a man seated, quite at his ease, upon the steps. Though he did not believe he had ever seen the man before, he knew him instantly. He was bad fortune personified. He was the ruin of Mr. Segundus's hopes and dreams. The man was dressed in a black coat of an old-fashioned cut, as worn and shabby as Mr. Segundus's own, and he had mud on his boots. With his long, ragged, dark hair, he looked like the portent of doom in a bad play. "Mr. Segundus, you cannot do this," he said in a Yorkshire accent.
I beg your pardon," said Mr. Segundus.
"The school, sir. You must give up this notion of a school."
"What?"
cried Mr. Segundus, bravely pretending that he did not know the man spoke an inevitable truth.
"Now, sir," continued the dark man, "you know me, and you know that when I say a thing is so, that thing will be so, however much you and I might privately regret it."
"But you're quite mistaken," said Mr. Segundus. "I do not know you. At least, I do not believe I ever saw you before."
"I am John Childermas, Mr. Norrell's servant. We last talked 9 years ago outside the cathedral in York. When you confined yourself to a few pupils, Mr. Segundus, I was able to turn a blind eye. I said nothing, and Mr. Norrell remained in ignorance of what you were doing. But a regular school for grown-up magicians, that is a different matter. You've been too ambitious, sir. He knows, Mr. Segundus. He knows, and it is his desire that you wind up the business immediately."
"But what has Mr. Norrell or Mr. Norrell's desires to do with me?"
I did not sign the agreement. You should know that I am not alone in this undertaking. I have friends now.
That is true, said Childermas, mildly amused. And Mrs. Lennox is a very rich woman, and an excellent woman for business. But does she have the friendship of every minister in the cabinet, like Mr. Norrell? Does she have his influence? Remember the Society of Learned Magicians, Mr. Segundus. Remember how he crushed them.
Childermas waited a moment, and then, since the conversation appeared to be at an end, he strode off in the direction of the stables. 5 minutes later, he reappeared on a big brown horse. Mr. Segundus was standing just as before, with his arms crossed, glaring at the paving stones. Childermas looked down at him.
I'm sorry it ends like this, sir. Yet surely all is not lost. This house is just as suited to another kind of school as it is for a magical one. You would not think it to look at me, but I am a very fine fellow, with a wide acquaintance among great people. Choose some other sort of school, and the next time I hear that a lord or lady has need of such an establishment for their little lordlings, I'll send them your way.
I do not want another kind of school, said Mr. Segundus peevishly.
Childermas smiled his sideways smile and rode away. Mr. Segundus travelled to Bath and informed his patroness of their dismal situation. She was full of indignation that some gentleman she had never even met should presume to instruct her in what she could and could not do. She wrote Mr. Norrell an angry letter. She got no reply, but her bankers, lawyers, and partners in other business ventures suddenly found themselves in receipt of odd letters from great people of their acquaintance, all complaining in an oblique fashion of Mr. Segundus's school. One of the bankers, an argumentative and obdurate old person, was unwise enough to wonder publicly, in the lobby of the House of Commons, what a school for magicians in Yorkshire could possibly have to do with him. The result was that several ladies and gentlemen, friends of Mr. Norrell, withdrew their patronage from his bank. In Mrs. Honeyfoot's drawing-room in York, a few evenings later, Mr. Segundus sat with his head in his hands, lamenting.
"'Tis as if some evil fortune is determined to torment me, holding out great prizes in front of me, only to snatch them away again.'
Mrs. Honeyfoot clucked sympathetically, patted his shoulder, and offered the same damning censure of Mr. Norrell with which she had consoled both Mr. Segundus and Mr. Honeyfoot for the past 9 years, to wit, that Mr. Norrell seemed a very odd gentleman, full of queer fancies, and that she would never understand him.
"'Why not write to Mr. Strange?' said Mr. Honeyfoot suddenly. "'He will know what to do.'
Mr. Segundus looked up. "'Oh, I know that Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell have parted, but still I should not like to be a cause of argument between them.'
"'Nonsense!' cried Mr. Honeyfoot. "'Have you not read the recent issues of The Modern Magician? This is the very thing Strange wants. Some principle of Norrellite magic that he can attack openly, and so bring the whole edifice tumbling down. Believe me, he will consider himself obliged to you for this opportunity. You know, Segundus, the more I think of it, the more I like this plan.
Mr. Segundus thought so too.
Let me only consult Mrs. Lennox, and if she is in agreement, then I shall certainly do as you suggest.
Mrs. Lennox's ignorance concerning recent magical events was extensive. She knew very little of Jonathan Strange other than his name, and that he had some vague connection to the Duke of Wellington. But she was quick to assure Mr. Segundus that if Mr. Strange disliked Mr. Norrell, then she was very much in his favour. So, on the 20th of December, Mr. Segundus sent Strange a letter informing him of Gilbert Norrell's actions in regard to the school at Staircross Hall. Unfortunately, far from leaping to Mr. Segundus's defence, Strange never even replied.
Chapter 42. Strange decides to write a book. June to December, 1815. It may very easily be imagined with what pleasure Mr. Norrell received the news that on his return to England, Mr. Strange had gone straight to Shropshire.
"And the best part of it is," Mr. Norrell told Lascelles, "that in the country he's unlikely to publish any more of those mischievous articles upon the magic of the Raven King."
"No, indeed, sir," said Lascelles, "for I very much doubt that he will have time to write them."
Mr. Norrell took a moment to consider what this might mean.
"Oh, have you not heard, sir?"
continued Lascelles. Strange is writing a book. He writes to his friends of nothing else. He began very suddenly about 2 weeks ago, and is, by his own account, making a very rapid progress. But then we all know with what ease Strange writes. He has sworn to put the entirety of English magic into his book. He told Sir Walter that he would be greatly astonished if he could cram it all into 2 volumes. He rather thinks that it will need 3. It is to be called The History and Practice of English Magic, and Murray has promised to publish it when it is done. There could scarcely have been worse news. Mr. Norrell had always intended to write a book himself. He intended to call it Precepts for the Education of a Magician, and he had begun it when he had first become tutor to Mr. Strange. His notes already filled 2 shelves of the little book-lined room on the 2nd floor. Yet he had always spoken of his book as something for the distant future. He had a quite unreasonable terror of committing himself to paper, which 8 years of London adulation had not cured. All his volumes of private notes and histories and journals had yet to be seen by anyone, except in a few instances by Strange and Childermas. Mr. Norrell could never believe himself ready to publish. He could never be sure that he had got at the truth. He didn't believe that he had thought long enough upon the matter. He did not know if it were a fit subject to place before the public. As soon as Mr. Lascelles had gone, Mr. Norrell called for a silver dish of clear water to be brought to him in his room on the 2nd floor. In Shropshire, Strange was working upon his book. He did not look up, but suddenly he smiled a little wryly and wagged his finger at the empty air, as if to tell some unseen person, "No." All the mirrors in the room had been turned to face the wall, and though Mr. Norrell spent several hours bent over his silver dish, by the end of the evening he was no wiser. On an evening at the beginning of December, Stephen Black was polishing silver in his room at the end of the kitchen passage. He looked down and discovered that the strings of his polishing apron were untying themselves. It was not that the bow had come loose. Stephen had never tied a lazy bow in his life, but rather that the strings were snaking about in a bold, decisive way, like apron strings that knew what they were about. Next, his polishing sleeves and polishing gloves slipped off his arms and hands and folded themselves up neatly upon the table. Then his coat leapt from the chair back where he had hung it. It took firm hold of him and helped him on with itself. Finally, the butler's room itself disappeared. Suddenly he was standing in a small apartment panelled in dark wood. A table took up most of the space. The table was laid with a cloth of scarlet linen with a deep and ornate border of gold and silver. It was crowded with gold and silver dishes, and the dishes were heaped with food. Jeweled ewers were filled with wine. Wax candles and gold candlesticks made a blaze of light, and incense burnt in 2 golden censers. Besides the table, the only other furniture were 2 carved wooden chairs draped with cloth of gold and made luxurious with embroidered cushions. In one of these chairs, the gentleman with the thistledown hair was sitting.
"Good evening, Stephen."
"Good evening, sir."
"You look a little pale tonight, Stephen. I hope you are not unwell."
"I'm merely a little out of breath, sir. I find these sudden removals to other countries and continents a little perplexing."
"Oh, but we are still in London, Stephen. This is the Jerusalem Coffee House in Cooper's Court. Do you not know it?"
"Yes, indeed, sir. Sir Walter would often sup here with his rich friends when he was a bachelor. It's just that it was never so magnificent before. As for this banquet, there are hardly any dishes here I recognize."
"Oh, that is because I have ordered an exact copy of a meal I ate in this very house 400 or 500 years ago. Here's a haunch of roasted wyvern and a pie of honeyed hummingbirds. Here is roasted salamander with a relish of pomegranates, and here a delicate fricassee of the combs of cockatrices, spiced with saffron and powdered rainbows, and ornamented with gold stars. Now, sit you down and eat. That will be the best cure for your dizziness. What will you take?"
"It's all very wonderful, sir, but I believe I see some plain pork steaks, which look very good indeed."
"Ah, Stephen, as ever your noble instincts have led you to pick the choicest dish of all. Though the pork steaks are indeed quite plain, They have been fried in fat that was rendered down from the exorcised ghosts of black Welsh pigs that wander through the hills of Wales at night, terrifying the inhabitants of that deplorable country. The ghostliness and ferocity of the pigs lends the steaks a wonderful flavour which is quite unlike any other, and the sauce which accompanies them is made from cherries that were grown in a centre's orchard.
Taking up a jewelled and gilded ewer, the gentleman poured Stephen a glass of ruby red wine.
"This wine is one of the vintages of hell, but do not allow yourself to be dissuaded from tasting it upon that account. I dare say you have heard of Tantalus, the wicked king who baked his little son in a pie and ate him. He has been condemned to stand up to his chin in a pool of water he cannot drink, beneath a vine laden with grapes he cannot eat. This wine is made from those grapes. And since the vine was planted there for the sole purpose of tormenting Tantalus, you may be sure the grapes have an excellent flavour and aroma, and so does the wine. The pomegranates, too, are from Persephone's own orchard.
Stephen tasted the wine and the pork steaks.
It is altogether excellent, sir.
What was the occasion when you dined here before?
Oh, I and my friends were celebrating our departure for the Crusades. William of Lanchester was here.
Footnote 1. William of Lanchester was John Usgalas's seneschal and favourite servant, and consequently one of the most important men in England.
And Tom Dundle.
Footnote 2. Thomas of Dundale, John Usgalas's first human servant. See footnote 2, chapter 45.
And many other noble lords and knights, both Christian and fairy. Of course, it was not a coffee house then. It was an inn. From where we sat, we looked out over a wide courtyard surrounded by carved and gilded pillars. Our servants, pages, and squires went to and fro, making everything ready for us to wreak a terrible revenge upon our wicked enemies. On the other side of the courtyard were the stables, where we housed not only the most beautiful horses in England, but three unicorns that another fairy, a cousin of mine, was taking to the Holy Lands to pierce our enemies through and through. Several talented magicians were seated at the table with us. They in no way resembled the horrors that pass for magicians nowadays. They were as handsome in their persons as they were accomplished in their art. The birds of the air stooped to hear their commands. The rains and the rivers were their servants. The north wind, the south wind, etc., etc., only existed to do their bidding. They spread their hands, and cities crumbled, or sprang up whole again. What a contrast to that horrible old man who sits in a dusty room muttering to himself and turning the pages of some ancient volume.
The gentleman ate some cockatrice fricassee thoughtfully.
The other one is writing a book, he said.
So I have heard, sir. Have you been to look at him recently? The gentleman frowned.
Aye. Did you just not hear me say that I consider these magicians the stupidest, most abominable men in England? No, I have not seen him above twice or three times a week since he left London. When he writes, he cuts his nibs rather square with an old penknife. I should be ashamed to use so battered and ugly an old knife, but these magicians endure all sorts of nastiness that you and I would shudder at. Sometimes he gets so lost in what he's writing that he forgets to mend his nib, and then the ink splatters onto his paper and into his coffee, and he pays no attention at all.
Stephen reflected how odd it was that the gentleman, who lived in a partly ruinous house surrounded by the grisly bones of bygone battles, should be so sensitive to disorder in other people's houses.
"And what of the subject of the book, sir?" he asked. "What is your opinion of that?"
"It is most peculiar. He describes all the most important appearances of my race in this country. There are accounts of how we have intervened in Britain's affairs for Britain's good and the greater glory of the inhabitants. He continually gives it as his opinion that nothing is so desirable as that the magicians of this age should immediately summon us up and beg for our assistance. Can you make anything of this, Stephen? I cannot. When I wish to bring the King of England to my house and show him all sorts of polite attentions, this same magician thwarted me. His behaviour upon that occasion seemed calculated to insult me."
"But I think, sir," said Stephen gently, "that perhaps he did not quite understand who or what you were."
"Oh, who can tell what these Englishmen understand? Their minds are so peculiar. It is impossible to know what they're thinking. I fear you will find it so, Stephen, when you are their king."
"I really have no wish to be king of anywhere, sir."
"You will feel differently when you are king. It's just that you're cast down at the thought of being excluded from Lost Hope and all your friends. Be easy upon that score. I, too, would be miserable if I thought that your elevation would be the means of parting us. But I see no necessity for you to reside permanently in England merely because you are its monarch. A week is the utmost any person of taste could be expected to linger in such a dull country. A week is more than enough.
But what of my duties, sir? It is my understanding that kings have a great deal of business, and as little as I want to be king, I should not wish—
My dear Stephen,
cried the gentleman in affectionate but amused delight.
That is what seneschals are for. They can perform all the dull business of government, while you remain with me at Lost Hope to enjoy our usual pleasures. You will return here every so often to collect your taxes and the tribute of conquered nations and put them into a bank. Though I suppose that once in a while it will be prudent to stay in England long enough to have your portrait painted, so that the populace may adore you all the more. Sometimes you may graciously permit all the most beautiful ladies in the land to wait in line to kiss your hands and fall in love with you. Then, all your duties performed to perfection, you can return to Lady Pole and me with a good conscience.
The gentleman paused and grew unusually thoughtful.
Though I must confess, he said at last, that my delight in the beautiful Lady Pole is not so overpowering as once it was. There is another lady whom I like much more. She is only moderately pretty, but the deficiency in beauty is more than compensated for by her lively spirits and sweet conversation. And this other lady has one great advantage over Lady Pole. As you and I both know, Stephen, however often Lady Pole visits my house, she must always go away again, in accordance with the magician's agreement. But in the case of this lady, there will be no need for any such foolish agreement. Once I have obtained her, I shall be able to keep her always at my side.
Stephen sighed. The thought of some other poor lady held prisoner and lost hope for ever and a day was melancholy indeed. Yet it would be foolish to suppose that he could do anything to prevent it, and it might be that he could turn it to Lady Pole's advantage. Perhaps, sir, he said respectfully, in that case, you would consider releasing her ladyship from her enchantment. I know her husband and friends will be glad to have her restored to them.
Oh, but I shall always regard Lady Pole as a most desirable addition to all our entertainments. A beautiful woman is always good company, and I doubt if her ladyship has her equal for beauty in England. There are not many to equal her in faerie. No, what you suggest is entirely impossible. But to return to the subject in hand, we must decide upon a scheme to pluck this other lady from her home and carry her off to Lost Hope. I know, Stephen, that you will be all the more eager to help me when I tell you that I consider the removal of this lady from England as quite essential to our noble aim of making you king. It will be a terrible blow to our enemies. It will cast them down into utter despair. It will produce strife and dissension amongst them. Oh, yes, it will be all good things to us, and all bad to them. We would fail in our lofty duties if we did anything less.
Stephen could make very little of this. Was the gentleman speaking of one of the princesses at Windsor Castle? It was well known that the king had gone mad when his youngest and favourite daughter died. Perhaps the gentleman with the thistle-down hair supposed that the loss of another princess might actually kill him, or loosen the wits of some other members of the royal family.
Now, my dear Stephen, said the gentleman, the question before us is, how may we fetch the lady away without anyone noticing, particularly the magicians?
He considered a moment.
I have it. Fetch me a piece of moss oak.
Sir?
It must be about your own girth and as tall as my collarbone.
I would gladly fetch it for you immediately, sir, but I do not know what moss oak is.
Ancient wood that has been sunk in peat bogs for countless centuries.
Then, sir, I fear we are not very likely to find any in London. There are no peat bogs here.
True, true.
The gentleman flung himself back in his chair and stared at the ceiling while he considered this tricky problem. Would any other sort of wood suit your purposes, sir? Asked Stephen. There is a timber merchant in Gracechurch Street who I dare say—
No, no, said the gentleman. This must be done—
At that instant, Stephen experienced the queerest sensation. He was plucked out of his chair and stood upon his feet,
At the same moment, the coffeehouse disappeared and was replaced by a pitch-black, ice-cold nothingness. Though he could see nothing at all, Stephen had the sense that he was in a wide, open place. A bitter wind howled about his ears, and a thick rain seemed to be falling upon him from all directions at once.
"Properly," continued the gentleman, in exactly the same tone as before. "There is a very fine piece of moss oak hereabouts. At least I think I remember."
His voice, which had been somewhere near Stephen's right ear, moved again.
"Stephen," he cried, "have you brought a flauter, a rutter, and a tusker?"
"What, sir? Which, sir?" "No, sir. I've not brought any of those things. To own the truth, I did not quite understand that we were going anywhere." Stephen found that his feet and ankles were deep in cold water. He tried to step aside. Immediately, the ground lurched most alarmingly, and he sank suddenly into it up to the middle of his calves. He screamed.
"Hmm?"
inquired the gentleman.
"I would never presume to interrupt you, sir, but the ground appears to be swallowing me up." "It is a bog," said the gentleman, hopefully. "It is certainly a most terrifying substance."
Stephen attempted to mimic the gentleman's calm, uninterested tone. He knew only too well that the gentleman set a great value upon dignity in every situation, and he feared that if he let the gentleman hear how terrified he was, there was every possibility that the gentleman would grow disgusted with him and wander off, leaving him to be sucked into the bog. He tried to move, but found nothing solid beneath his feet. He flailed about, almost fell, and the only result was that his feet and legs slipped a little further into the watery mud. He screamed again. The bog made a series of most unpleasant sucking noises.
"Oh, God, I take the liberty of observing, sir, that I am sinking by degrees. Ah!"
He began to slip sideways.
"You have often been so kind as to express an affection for me, sir, and to say how much you prefer my society to that of any other person. If it would not inconvenience you in any way, perhaps I might prevail upon you to rescue me from this horrible bog."
The gentleman did not trouble to reply. Instead, Stephen found himself plucked by magic out of the bog and stood upon his feet. He was quite weak with fright, and would have liked to lie down, but dared not move. The ground here seemed solid enough, but it was unpleasantly wet, and he had no idea where the bog was.
I would gladly help you, sir," he called into the darkness, "but I dare not move for fear of falling into the bog again."
"Ah, it does not matter," said the gentleman. "In truth, there is nothing to do but wait. Moss oak is most easily discovered at dawn."
"But dawn is not for another 9 hours," exclaimed Stephen in horror.
"Indeed. Let us sit down and wait."
"Here, sir? But this is a dreadful place, black and cold and awful."
"Oh, quite, it is most disagreeable,"
agreed the gentleman with aggravating calmness. He fell silent then, and Stephen could only suppose that he was pursuing this mad plan of waiting for the dawn. The icy wind blew upon Stephen. The damp seeped up into every part of his being. The blackness pressed down upon him, and the long hours passed with excruciating slowness. He had no expectation of being able to sleep, but at some time during the night he experienced a little relief from the misery of his situation. It was not that he fell asleep exactly, but he did fall to dreaming. In his dream, he had gone to the pantry to fetch someone a slice of a magnificent pork pie. But when he cut the pie open, he found that there was very little pork inside it. Most of the interior was taken up by the city of Birmingham. Within the pie crust, forges and smithies smoked and engines pounded. One of the citizens, a civil-looking person, happened to stroll out from the cut that Stephen had made, and when his glance fell upon Stephen, he said, and just then a high, mournful sound broke in upon Stephen's dream, a slow, sad song in an unknown language, and Stephen understood, without ever actually waking, that the gentleman with the thistle-down hair was singing. It may be laid down as a general rule that if a man begins to sing, no one will take any notice of his song except his fellow human beings. And this is true even if his song is surpassingly beautiful. Other men may be in raptures at his skill, but the rest of creation is, by and large, unmoved. Perhaps a cat or a dog may look at him. His horse, if it's an exceptionally intelligent beast, may pause in cropping the grass. But that is the extent of it. But when the fairy sang, the whole world listened to him. Stephen felt clouds pause in their passing. He felt sleeping hills shift and murmur.
he felt cold mists dance. He understood for the first time that the world is not dumb at all, but merely waiting for someone to speak to it in a language it understands. In the fairy's song, the earth recognized the names by which it called itself. Stephen began to dream again. This time he dreamt that hills walked and the sky wept. Trees came and spoke to him and told him their secrets, and also whether or not he might regard them as friends or enemies. Important destinies were hidden inside pebbles and crumpled leaves. He dreamt that everything in the world, stones and rivers, leaves and fire, had a purpose which it was determined to carry out with the utmost rigor. But he also understood that it was possible sometimes to persuade things to a different purpose. When he awoke, it was dawn, or something like dawn. The light was watery, dim, and incomparably sad. Vast grey, gloomy hills rose up all around them, and in between the hills there was a wide expanse of black bog. Stephen had never seen a landscape so calculated to reduce the onlooker to utter despair in an instant. "This is one of your kingdoms, I suppose, sir," he said.
"My kingdoms?" exclaimed the gentleman in surprise. "Oh, no. This is Scotland."
The gentleman disappeared suddenly and reappeared a moment later with an armful of tools. There was an axe and a spit and three things Stephen had never seen before. One was like a little hoe, one was like a little spade, and the last was a very strange object, something between a spade and a scythe. He handed all of them to Stephen, who examined them with a puzzled air.
"Are they new, sir? They shine so brightly."
"Well, obviously one cannot employ tools of ordinary metal for such a magical undertaking as I am proposing. These are made from a compound of quicksilver and starshine. Now, Stephen, we must look for a patch of ground where the dew has not settled, and if we dig there, we are sure to find moss oak."
All through the glen, all the grasses and tiny coloured bog plants were covered with dew. Stephen's clothes, hands, hair, and skin had a velvety grey bloom, and the gentleman's hair, which was always extraordinary, had added the sparkle of a million tiny spheres of water to its customary brilliance. He appeared to be wearing a jewelled halo. The gentleman walked slowly across the glen, his eyes fixed upon the ground. Stephen followed.
"Ah!" cried the gentleman. "Here we are!"
How the gentleman knew this, Stephen could not tell. They were standing in the middle of a boggy expanse, exactly like every other part of the glen. There was no distinguishing tree or rock nearby to mark the spot, but the gentleman strode on with a confident air until he came to a shallow depression. In the middle of the depression was a long, broad stripe where there was no dew at all.
"Dig here, Stephen."
The gentleman proved surprisingly knowledgeable about the art of peat cutting, and though he did none of the actual work himself, he carefully instructed Stephen how to cut away the uppermost layer of grasses and moss with one tool, how to cut the peat with another tool, and how to lift out the pieces with a third. Stephen was unaccustomed to hard labor, and he was soon out of breath, and every part of him ached. Fortunately, he had not cut down very far, and he struck something much harder than the peat.
"Ah," cried the gentleman, very well pleased. "That is the moss oak. Excellent. Now, Stephen, cut around it."
This was easier said than done. Even when Stephen had cut away enough of the peat to expose the moss oak to the air, it was still very difficult to see what was oak and what was peat. Both were black, wet, and oozing. He dug some more, and he began to suspect that though the gentleman called it a log, this was, in fact, an entire tree.
"Could you not lift it out by magic, sir?" he asked. "Oh, no, no, indeed. I shall ask a great deal of this wood, and therefore it is incumbent upon us to make its passage from the bog into the wider world as easy as we can. Now, do take this axe, Stephen, and cut me a piece as tall as my collarbone. Then, with the spit and the tusker, we will prize it out."
It took them 3 more hours to accomplish the task. Stephen chopped the wood to the size the gentleman had asked for, but the task of maneuvering it out of the bog was more than one man could manage, and the gentleman was obliged to descend into the muddy, stinking hole with him, and they strained and pulled and heaved together. When at last they had finished, Stephen threw himself upon the ground in a condition of the utmost exhaustion, while the gentleman stood regarding his log with delight.
"Well," he said, That was a great deal easier than I had imagined.
Stephen suddenly found himself once more in the upper room of the Jerusalem coffee house. He looked at himself and at the gentleman. Their good clothes were in tatters, and they were covered from head to foot with bog mud. For the first time, he was able to see the log of moss oak properly. It was as black as sin, extremely fine-grained, and it oozed black water. "We must dry it out before it will be fit for anything," he said.
"Oh, no," said the gentleman with a brilliant smile. "For my purposes, it will do very well as it is."
Chapter 43. The Curious Adventure of Mr. Hyde, December 1815. One morning in the first week of December, Jeremy knocked upon the door of Stranger's Library at Ashfair House and said that Mr. Hyde begged the favour of a few minutes' conversation with him. Strange was not best pleased to be interrupted. Since he had been in the country, he had grown almost as fond of quiet and solitude as Norrell. "Oh, very well," he muttered. Delaying only to write another paragraph, look up three or four things in a biography of Valentine Greatrakes, blot his paper, correct some spellings, and blot his paper again, he went immediately to the drawing-room. A gentleman was sitting alone by the fire, staring pensively into the flames. He was a vigorous-looking, active sort of man of 50 or so years, dressed in the stout clothes and boots of a gentleman farmer. On a table at his side there was a little glass of wine and a small plate of biscuits. Clearly Jeremy had decided that the visitor had sat alone long enough to require some refreshment. Mr. Hyde and Jonathan Strange had been neighbours all their lives, but the marked differences in their fortunes and tastes had meant that they had never been more than common acquaintances. This was, in fact, the first time they had met since Strange had become a magician. They shook hands.
"I dare say, sir," began Mr. Hyde, "you are wondering what can bring me to your door in such weather."
"The weather?"
"Well, yes, sir. It's very bad."
Strange looked out of the window. The high hills surrounding Ashfair were sheathed in snow. Every branch, every twig, bore its burden of snow. The very air seemed white with frost and mist.
"So it is. I had not observed. I have not been out of the house since Sunday."
"Your servant tells me that you are very much occupied with your studies. I beg your pardon for interrupting you, but I have something to tell you which can wait no longer."
"Oh, there is no explanation necessary. And how is your—" Strange paused and tried to remember whether Mr. Hyde had a wife, any children, brothers, sisters, or friends. He found he was entirely without information upon the subject.
"Farm," he finished.
"I recollect it's at Aston."
"It is nearer to Clumbury."
"Clumbury, yes.
All is well with me, Mr. Strange, except for something rather unsettling, which happened to me 3 days ago. I've been debating with myself ever since whether I ought to come and speak to you about it. I've asked the advice of my friends and my wife, and we'll all agree that I ought to tell you what I've seen. 3 days ago, I had business on the Welsh side of the border, with David Evans. I dare say you know him, sir."
"I know him by sight. I've never spoken to him. Ford knows him, I believe."
Ford was the agent who managed all the business of Strange's estate.
"Well, sir, David Evans and I had finished our business by 2 o'clock, and I was very anxious to get home. There was a thick snow lying everywhere, and the roads between here and Lamphire Waterdine were very bad. I dare say you don't know it, sir, but David Evans' house is high up on a hill with a long view westwards. And the moment he and I stepped outside, we saw great grey clouds full of snow coming towards us. Mrs. Evans, David's mother, pressed me to stay with them and come home the next day. But Evans and I talked it over, and we both agreed that all would be well providing I left instantly and came home by the most direct way possible. In other words, I should ride up to the dyke and cross over into England before the storm was upon me."
Footnote 1. The dyke is a great wall of earth and stones, now much decayed, which divides Wales from England, the work of Offa, an 8th-century Mercian king, who had learned by experience to distrust his Welsh neighbours.
"The dyke," said Strange, frowning. "Well, that is a steep ride, even in summer, and a very lonely place if anything were to happen to you. I do not think I would have attempted it, but I dare say you know these hills and their temper better than I." "Perhaps you are wiser than I, sir. As I rode up the dyke,
A hard, high wind began to blow, and it caught up the snow that had already fallen and carried it up into the air. The snow stuck to my horse's coat and to my own greatcoat, so that when I looked down, we were as white as the hillside, as white as the air, as white as everything. The wind made eerie shapes with the snow, so that I seemed to be surrounded by spinning ghosts and the kind of evil spirits and bad angels that are in the Arabian Ladies stories. My poor horse, who was not generally a nervous beast, seemed to be seeing all manner of things to frighten him. As you may imagine, I was beginning to wish very heartily that I had accepted Mrs. Evans' hospitality, when I heard the sound of a bell tolling.
A bell? Said Strange.
Yes, sir. But what bell could there have been?
Well, none at all, sir, in that lonely place. Indeed, it is a wonder to me that I could have heard anything at all, what with the horse snorting and the wind howling.
Strange, who imagined that Mr. Hyde must have come in order to have this queer bell explained to him, began to talk of the magical significance of bells, how bells were used as a protection against fairies and other evil spirits, and how a bad fairy might sometimes be frightened away by the sound of a church bell. And yet, at the same time, it was well known that fairies loved bells. Fairy magic was often accompanied by the tolling of a bell, and bells often sounded when fairies appeared.
I cannot explain this odd contradiction, he said. Theoretical magicians have puzzled over it for centuries.
Mr. Hyde listened to this speech with every appearance of politeness and attentiveness. When Strange had finished, Mr. Hyde said,
But the bell was just the beginning, sir.
Oh, said Strange, a little annoyed. Very well. Continue.
I got so far up the hill that I could see the dike where it runs along the top. There were a few bent trees, some broken-down walls of loose stones. I looked to the south, and I saw a lady walking very fast along the dike towards me.
A lady?
I saw her very clearly. Her hair was loose, and the wind was setting it on end and making it writhe about her head.
Mr. Hyde gestured with his hands to show how the lady's hair had danced in the snowy air.
I think I called out to her. I know that she turned her head and looked at me, but she did not stop or slow her pace. She turned away again and walked on along the dike with all the snowy wraiths around her. She wore only a black gown, no shawl, no pelisse, and that made me very afraid for her. I thought that some dreadful accident must have befallen her. So I urged my horse up the hill as fast as the poor creature could go. I tried to keep her in sight the whole time, but the wind kept carrying the snow into my eyes. I reached the dike, and she was nowhere to be seen. So I rode back and forth along the dike. I searched and cried myself hoarse. I was sure she must have fallen down behind a heap of stones or snow, or tripped in some rabbit hole, or perhaps been carried away by the person who had done her the evil in the first place.
The evil?
Well, sir, I suppose that she must have been carried to the dike by someone who meant her harm. One hears such terrible things nowadays.
You knew the lady?
Yes, sir.
Who was it?
Mrs. Strange.
There was a moment's silence.
But it could not have been, said Strange, perplexed.
Mr. Hyde, if anything of a distressing nature had happened to Mrs. Strange, I think someone would have told me. I'm not so shut up with my books as that. I'm sorry, Mr. Hyde, but you're mistaken. Whoever this poor woman was, it was not Mrs. Strange.
Mr. Hyde shook his head. If I saw you, sir, in Shrewsbury or Ludlow, I might not know you immediately. But Mrs. Strange's father was curate of my parish for 47 years. I've known Mrs. Strange, Miss Woodhope, as she was then, since she was an infant, taking her first steps in Clunbury Churchyard. Even if she had not looked at me, I would have known her. I would have known her by her figure, by her way of walking, by her everything.
What did you do after you lost sight of the woman?
I rode straight here, but your servant would not let me in.
Jeremy, the man you spoke to just now?
Yes, he told me that Mrs. Strange was safe within.
I confess that I did not believe him, so I walked around your house and looked in at all the windows until I saw her seated upon a sofa in this very room.
Mr. Hyde pointed to the sofa in question. She was wearing a pale blue gown, not black at all.
Well, there's nothing remarkable in that. Mrs. Strange never wears black. It is not a color I like to see a young woman wear.
Mr. Hyde shook his head and frowned. I wish I could convince you, sir, of what I saw.
but I see that I cannot. And I wish I could explain it to you, but I cannot. They shook hands at parting. Mr. Hyde looked solemnly at Strange and said, I never wished her harm, Mr. Strange. Nobody could be more thankful that she is safe. Strange bowed slightly. And we intend to keep her so. The door closed upon Mr. Hyde's back.